Thanks very much. Good morning, everyone. And Al, that was a very kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be hosted by the other venerable health department here in Boston. I also want to give a shout out to Marcy Layton, also a member of the executive board of CSTE and a key member of our department. I have an important topic today, and I'm so delighted to see so many younger people in the audience because my overarching ambition is to show to you the foundational role for practicing epidemiologists in advancing public health as social justice and addressing the enduring inequities that we see in New York and across the nation. I'm going to start out with an overview. I'm going to encourage you to extend your purview as epidemiologists and how you measure and tell you a few stories of how we, how I think we can do that. I'm going to talk about how we can use data to tell stories, how it underlies our research and policy initiatives, and then I'm going to end up with a few neighborhood-level initiatives that have started since I've been commissioner in New York City. I thought I would, though, say a few framing words about the concept of public health as social justice. This, of course, is not a new idea. And Nancy Krieger, and who I know will be talking to you tomorrow, and Anne Emanuel, wrote about this in commemorating 150 years of public health as social justice in the spirit of 1848. And they reminded us that this is foundational to our legacy, but also cautioned us that public health is not by definition progressive. And in fact, it has many strands, repressive as well as progressive. And these strands become especially apparent when we turn to the exploration of racial disparities in health, a discussion that taps into our nation's legacy of racial oppression. For me and most of my generation, a guiding framework remains the Declaration of Amaata. Many people of my generation, who I'm glad to see are in the minority in the audience, remember this from the formative years of our careers, and some of you may not have heard of it at all. So allow me just to take a moment to read from the second paragraph of this declaration, which was signed in 1978. Thank you for that. The existing gross inequality in the health status of people, particularly between developed and developing countries, as well as within countries, is politically, socially, and economically unacceptable, and therefore of common concern to all nations. It seems hard to remember, hard to imagine, that 192 UN member states, including our own nation, the United States, were signatory to this declaration, and it continues to reverberate across our national framing of the concept of equity. It remains enshrined in many important public health documents, and it continues to reference discrimination, exclusion, and other barriers that are societal and not only the creation of individuals. So for all of you, whether you collect whatever type of data you are involved in collecting, analyzing, and sharing, whether you work in communicable disease, maternal and child health, occupational health, environmental health, injury or chronic disease prevention, all the broad span of preventable causes of death, these data are really important to our action. And I want to encourage you to think of any event that has a health consequence and a denominator, that it belongs to you as practicing epidemiologists. And I'm going to reflect on some recent examples from the analysis of legal intervention as a cause of death, and more recently in New York City, to the issue of paid family leave. Last fall, our press was awash with headlines like these. Just on Sunday, our local newspaper, the New York Times, again had a headline about the death of Eric Garner, a black man who died in a chokehold in New York City. And the hashtag Black Lives Matters banner was raised, a phrase that our mayor, Bill de Blasio, aptly noted, should never have to be used. Now, if you want to get data about what's happening in terms of death to legal intervention, I can tell you where you can find it. You can find it on the website of a British newspaper, The Guardian Weekly. And so, since the first of this year, there have been some 500 deaths. Eerily, we can watch daily as the number of deaths increase. And I think there's something ironic that the source of these data are in a British newspaper. But Nancy Krieger, who, again, will probably be talking about this some tomorrow, went to work with her team, and she put together some data to go with the anguish of the headlines that I've shown you. And in doing this, she showed the power of surveillance to contribute to a national discussion by showing time trends of deaths due to legal intervention by race and income. And here you go. It's really a fascinating graph. There's a lot here in the graph, and maybe she'll talk about it tomorrow. But I think that the big take-home message here is that the likelihood of a young black man, can you make that out from where you're the top line, I don't need to tell you, is deaths due to legal intervention. This is the police and any law enforcing officer. The top lines, the solid lines, are black men between the ages of 15 and 34, and the bottom dashed lines are whites. The top red line is by income, higher income quintile, and the blue line is lower income quintiles. Anyway, what you can see, though, is that the racial disparity is enduring, that it has remained in recent years about 2.5 to 3-fold higher among young black men. Now, this graph leaves out entirely the notion of legality. This is simply counting the number of deaths due to law enforcing agents. And my intention in showing you this graph is to encourage you to think about the type of data that practicing public health epidemiologists can bring to bear on national conversations. As the health commissioner in New York City, I found these data to be very useful. And I, in fact, turned to Dr. Krieger to give us some data from New York City. And these are our New York City-specific data. And you can see, once again, that New York City sort of parallels the national average, often is higher than the national average. I can't help but notice that as mass incarceration temporarily began to skyrocket in the 1980s, the number of deaths here declined. Of course, public health had other leadership roles in response to the uprisings that occurred following what many saw as the unjust deaths of unarmed black men at the hands of the police. This is something that was published by the Health Commissioner of Baltimore, along with Josh Sharfstein, the former city and state health commissioner. And they talked about the importance of ensuring that people continue to have access to medications as pharmacies were closed, in increasing access to supports for the population in terms of mental health, providing hotlines. And as you heard in Al's kind introduction, I used the events of last year to broaden the conversation and talk about the fact that the impact of racism on health extends beyond the issue of violence, beyond the issue, indeed, of police violence, and includes the excess mortality from many conditions, including chronic conditions. I met with students from around area medical schools who had led a die-in as part of White Coats for Black Lives, and I'm continuing a dialogue with the deans at different institutions about the composition of their incoming student body. One of the schools last year had only a single African-American entering medical student. So these data, though, I would urge you to consider really anchor our conversation and make it real. And data also are useful to us as we display them and are useful in public health advocacy. I love maps because maps really help make injustice visible and they generate outrage and the political will for action and change. And they also give us guidance on how to target our interventions. And we can make maps, all kinds of maps, global maps, national maps, local maps. Here's one national map on premature mortality, which New York City's Health Department has recently adopted as a key indicator that it will seek to reduce. We have a target, 25% reduction in premature mortality over the next 25 years. And you can see huge variation in premature mortality across our nation, and we can talk about how it varies by where we live, what our income is, what our education is, and what our race is, broadly what people describe as the social determinants of health. And maps can also be used in a more local frame. These data are displayed along transit lines in a strategy that has been promoted by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And these place on a very familiar map for residents the huge variation in life expectancy. Here you can see in Washington, D.C., that life expectancy varies from 77 to 84 years just along the red line. In New Orleans, there's an even starker picture with a 25-year difference in life expectancy with a spin on the highway. So maps help show us inequality. I'm in Boston now. I should have brought you your own map because it would show something similar. But here's New York City. We have a variation of 11 years from Brownsville, a very poor neighborhood in Brooklyn, to Murray Hill, where the life expectancy is the highest in the city. And you can see here along the number 6 train the huge variations in life expectancy that occur. And maps can also be used to help us make inferences and look at relationships. This is a map that shows how New York City is a very segregated city. We are among the most segregated cities in the country. And you can see that in our city, race and poverty are very closely aligned with the same neighborhoods that are poor, tending to be Black and Latino. And it also reminds me to point out to you that neighborhood-based approaches work because of residential segregation. When our cities are divided by race, ethnicity, and income, factors that have such an important bearing on health, it makes sense to focus on neighborhoods as a way of reaching communities that are the sickest in our cities. And here you can see some maps shown here. Basically, you don't need to be able to read that. The darker the colors, the sicker the communities. And it really still shocks me to see the systematic clustering of poor health outcomes in the same neighborhoods that are all communities of color. And these occur regardless of the causal pathway, across the life course, whether we're talking about infectious diseases, non-communicable diseases, all of which suggest that much larger structural factors are at play. And here we are with premature mortality. And this really shows us the work that we have cut out for us in seeking to reduce premature mortality. Of course, whenever we look at these data, the real question to ask ourselves is, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to change these outcomes? But before turning to that, which is what I want to talk about for the bulk of my talk, I want to point out that simply documenting these variations, being able to display these maps, showing these differences that are unnecessary, unjust, and can be changed, is doing something. And as New York City's health commissioner, I will cut programs before I cut our ability to bear witness to these changing patterns in communities and before I give up our opportunity to conduct surveillance that is so important to advancing health equity. But, of course, we must act. And I have already mentioned that New York City has a citywide plan. It's called, it was initially called Plan NYC under Bloomberg. He took an economic development plan and added to it the lens of environmental sustainability. On Earth Day, our mayor, Bill de Blasio, introduced One NYC, which updates this plan and adds an equity lens, a crucial equity lens to the city's goals in academic and economic development. It has a very ambitious set of goals: job growth, clean air, zero waste, cutting green gas emissions, and so on, as well as the goals that you see there. And I mentioned our goal of reducing premature mortality by 25%. This is what we've done in the past decade. We've seen a 16% decline in mortality. So our goal of 25% by 2040 is entirely achievable, but we all know the asymptotic way in which decline occurs. So this is an achievable but not an inevitable goal, which we are pursuing by leveraging research, policy, and a focus on neighborhoods. So now let me show you some examples of research in action. Now there are some young people in the room, so I want to remind you that when we conduct research, the first goal is always to ask the right questions. And in New York City, we're thinking hard about the way in which we demarcate neighborhoods. This is a complex question. Everyone has different ways of doing it. There's zip codes, school districts, community districts, census tracts. We're doing a pilot now. I hope people will be willing to give us their addresses, because the best thing would be being able to geocode these data and put the right community borders around them. And we're also really committed to having measures that reflect neighborhoods that are not simply the aggregate of individuals. We want to have measures of neighborhood well-being that don't just aggregate up individual measures. So this, for example, would be something like how many daycare facilities there are, not just how many people go to daycare. And one of the things that I did when I became health commissioner was put more funding into this effort. We want to put more data into the hands of communities. Over a decade ago, Tom Frieden created the Community Health Survey, a risk factor type survey, and created these neighborhood-specific health reports. They were last issued over 5 years ago. We've increased the sample size and so that we can now issue these reports for community districts, which are overseen by planning boards. My staff would want me to point out to you that cover is still in draft. And our goal here is to make data available to community organizations and to the community planning process. Let me give you an example of how our data can help support policies. I've been heartened by, and our staff have been heartened by, the modernization of family leave policies in California. Leave policies following the childbirth have undoubted benefits, and we have seen in California increasing the duration from 3 to 6 weeks, having huge benefits, especially for low-income and black mothers. So when this appeared before our state legislature, we mobilized to try and make some data available that would help inform this conversation, and used the CDC's PRAMS data, where we had been asking questions of women about their return to work. And I hope that you can read this to see that only a minority of women had paid leave available to them, about 40%. But of course, for many of those women, that meant accrued vacation time. So that measure was a little misleading. And many women had to take unpaid leave. And we also found out something about who took leave, that women were more likely, not surprisingly, to take leave if they had higher education, earned more money. And when women took unpaid leave, this had a real impact on their families. So it wasn't just, this was a real sacrifice, and these women were more likely to be concerned about having enough food for their children. So I don't know whether this will make it through our legislature this year, but I think that these data were really important data to advocacy. And knowing more about how the women felt about taking leave was also important. One in five, 20%, were concerned that they would lose their job if they took more leave to take care of their child. And importantly, this was a voluntary question added by our team, but because it was so important, the PRAMS has decided to make it part of the national data collection. So we can look forward to seeing data on the use of leave by women after childbirth from around the country. Now, let me tell you a little bit about how we have used our data to inform policy. And this is something that we've just recently put forward, a strategy to tackle heart disease as a leading killer in the United States. It's obviously part of any effort to reduce mortality. We have proposed to our Board of Health that we put warning icons on menus and menu boards and fast food and restaurant chains. How do we know this about sodium consumption in New York City? Well, because New York City has conducted an NYC-specific Haines, we even got 24-hour urine collections in collaboration with our city university. And we know a great deal about the sodium intake. It's much too high. And we know that too few consumers are aware of the impact of sodium on health. And we know that it is our dietary reliance on processed and prepared foods that is responsible for most of the sodium in our diet. So we are hopeful that this amendment will let people make better choices about their selections. And of course, this is an equity strategy because we know that racial disparities in health are importantly driven by high blood pressure and that in turn is affected by salt intake. Now, let me turn to a key part of our strategy to advance equity, which is to use place-based or neighborhood-based approaches. When I returned from Zimbabwe, I don't know whether Al mentioned that I spent nearly 20 years of my working life in Harare, Zimbabwe, where district health was part of the way in which ministries delivered services. And over a decade ago, when I was at the health department before, I helped establish three district public health offices in familiar neighborhoods, Central and East Harlem, the South Bronx, Central Brooklyn. And when we looked at the data again, when I became commissioner, these are still our poorest neighborhoods, the ones in which we should direct intensified approaches. And these aren't the only neighborhoods that we have that are needy in the city, but these are the ones that we are currently focused on. We are reimagining health offices that were established in the LaGuardia era that aimed to provide they previously provided mostly health services to these neighborhoods. These were largely underutilized, sometimes used as storage space, and we have refurbished three centers. We are putting them on offer to community-based organizations as well as to healthcare delivery systems, clinics, FQHCs, and we are looking to co-locate these activities so that we can support a joint planning process that will support the acceleration of the health advancement in these areas. We also have initiated a community health worker project. The data there in red show what we call hot spotting with our A1C registry. We made hemoglobin A1C reportable in New York City in 2006. And this shows a public housing project. The red are hemoglobin A1Cs over 9. That's people with uncontrolled diabetes. So we are able to use these reportable, this reportable measure as a way of identifying areas where we need to give people more help in being connected to healthcare. And we have all sorts of ideas for these district health offices, a communal kitchen, an urban garden, a space for new moms to congregate to support each other in breastfeeding. But the ultimate goal of this effort is to use data to target our efforts and bring together people to work collectively to advance the health in their neighborhoods. So that's the work that we're doing. And I would be happy, I guess I'm a little ahead of time. Yeah, okay. Thank you.